All right, this is the word of the Lord. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband, and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying this, I have no husband. For you have had 5 husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband at all. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers have worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must in spirit and truth." And the woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, he who is called the Christ. And when he comes, he will tell us all these things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." The word of the Lord.
Thank you, Pastor Jalen. Good morning, good morning, good morning. My name is Scott. I'm the lead pastor here at the Old Jacob's Well. And we're going to be talking about that very thing, Jacob's Well, this morning. This is something that we do at the beginning of every calendar year. If you're here for a while, hopefully you get more and more familiar with this story. If this is your first time hearing it, this is just this is really important for us. This is kind of our guiding North Star, as you'll hear about in a second. Before we get into the teaching, though, turn to someone, tell them how you ended up here this morning. And if anyone wants to sit in the first 4 rows of the middle, the first 2 rows over there, come on forward. We'd love to have you. Talk to each other. Ready, set, go. All right, everybody. I Away we go. If you've been watching college football of late, the legend of Kurt Cignetti continues to rise. He is the coach of IU football. Morgan and Nicole are both. And he said something really interesting that got a lot of attention. Somebody asked him, how did you turn this program around? Indiana University football was the second most losing football program in the country until this year. And now they're in the national championship game and the prohibitive favorites to win. It's like, how do you turn a program around that quickly? And what Cignetti said is, he said, if you have the right people, and if you have a good plan, and if you have the right standard, it's amazing what can happen. And if you'll allow me, because I've been immersed in that, I just kept thinking about that with Vision Sunday. It's when people ask us as a church, what makes you guys run? It's what I enjoy about our church is we have wonderful people here, yourselves included, so good on you. But we've also always had a standard here, and we've always had a plan here. And not to say that we're, you know, a successful church, that's gross and not something that we particularly care about, but insofar as we've tried to be faithful to God, that has been a huge part of it. And the purpose of Vision Sunday is a little bit unique, and I know those of you who have been around a long time are always a little bit, like, conflicted about Vision Sunday, because you're like, this is my 64th Vision Sunday or whatever. It can feel like that. We do this twice a year, and yet I do think that sort of that sense of there's a plan, there's something that we're actually trying to accomplish here largely comes from our deep-rooted commitment to our vision, to this text that was just read to us, at least in part, from John 4, that we're not just doing church here. We're not just here to run sort of the same playbook, right? Like, we believe that God has given us a specific vision, a specific task, and a specific passion here in Central New Jersey. And that passion comes from this text and that vision. What is vision? Vision is a North Star. Vision is the thing that you are. I just read this fascinating book about Teddy Roosevelt, who, after he was president, he just couldn't get enough of adventure and taking risks and all these things. And so he decides, which is crazy, he decides, let's go map a new tributary of the Amazon River that no one's ever been to, where all of these things could kill us, animals and diseases and all this craziness. And he goes and he charts this river, and it's actually a fascinating story. It's called The River of Doubt. Check it out. It's a very interesting book. But one of the things that they do every single night is that they look up at the stars and try and figure out where are we, because that gives them a sense of where they are on the map, where they've been down this river, and sort of where they're headed. It's something that they pause every single night, and they have people on the expedition who this is their only job, is they're sort of navigators, and they look at the heavens and they figure out, okay, we're about where we're supposed to be, or we're way off, or wow, we're so much farther east than we thought we would be. For us, if you'll go with it, for us, that's what this story serves as. Does this story still resonate to what we're doing at any given moment? Are we on track? Is this something that we still can say for our church, like, yeah, that feels like us still? And so that's why we do this so often in returning to this story. It's our time to stop, to look up at our North Star and say, okay, how are we doing and where are we headed? And so, if you've been around, you know the broad outlines of the story. If this is new to you, very, very briefly, this is early in John, one of the stories of Jesus' life told by, as far as we can tell, John was really his best earthly friend. And this comes early in that story. And Jesus is going from the southern part of sort of what we think of as kind of the Holy Land now. He's going from Jerusalem back up to his hometown-ish, and we are told at the beginning of the story that he had to pass through this region that was called Samaria, that had to pass through. Again, those of you who are around, you know what that is. That's called a divine imperative in John's gospel. This is not, he actually had to do this. In fact, this was the inconvenient route to get from the southern part of where he was going to the northern part. This instead is not saying this was the only option he had. Instead, it's geographically or by the traffic, you know, patterns or something. No, this is the only choice he had, because God called him to this, and God had something for him in the specific path that he sent Jesus down. On that path, he comes to a village called Sychar, And there is this well there that happens to be called Jacob's Well. That is from an Old Testament story that we could go through another time, but it is literally called Jacob's Well. So this is not, my name is not Jacob. This is not my well. We're not some weirdo place, right? People don't know what we are by our sign out there, but we are a local church that is striving to be the kind of place where what happened at this ancient Jacob's well continues to happen. That's the idea, okay? So there's this well there. Jesus hangs out at the well. He's tired from this journey that he's going on. He sends his disciples into town to get food. And while he is there, he has an interaction. He has an encounter with a woman. It happens to be the longest interpersonal one-on-one conversation we have in all of the Gospels. What was Jesus like? How did he interact? What was he like conversationally? The best answer we have to that is John 4. It's the longest sustained back and forth interaction that we have anywhere about Jesus. It's one of the things that I just love is you get a sense of the way in which he gauged people. I couldn't help but think this week that what we see, the sort of pattern, the kind of rhythm that he creates in this interaction with this woman is almost certainly something that was replicated elsewhere, but normally what we have are just these really quick mentions, right? I was thinking of specific characters, like he goes into the house of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, right? You're like, why do they all know that? That's a song that you sing if you grow up in Sunday school. But Zacchaeus, this little guy, Jesus goes into his house. He's a tax collector. He's a pariah. Nobody likes him. And by the time they're done, this guy's life is like radically different. And he's promising to give back everything he's stolen from the people. Wouldn't you love to know what in the world happened in that man's dining table, you know? And I think that we probably have some hints. I just couldn't help but think it's probably what it was like. Jesus has this interaction very briefly with this blind man named Bartimaeus who calls out to him, and then Jesus interacts with him for a while. By the time he's done, not only is he healed of his blindness, but his life is forever radically changed. And all the people who observe this, and surely that interaction was a lot longer and a lot more involved than just the few sentences that we have. And so that's what I love about this story from which we get our name. It's a sustained interaction between Jesus and this one. Now, we don't have time to walk through it. Again, keep coming back and you'll get paragraphs here and there of this interaction every time we do this thing called Vision Sunday. What I really want to concentrate on now comes about midway through the conversation. So they begin a conversation. Jesus says, I'm thirsty. Would you get me something to drink? And this woman immediately recognizes all of the barriers that exist between her and Jesus and the unlikelihood of this interaction happening at all. What should have happened is that Jesus turned his back on this woman. This woman quietly went about her business alone at the well and gets to walk away having not interacted, right? Like this should have been a New Jersey interaction, right? Like, go to Wawa, hope no one looks at me, right? And I just kind of do my thing and I leave. That's what should have happened. She is stunned that Jesus is interacting with her. She certainly recognized that he's a man. She probably has some sense that he's a Jewish man, either by his garb or by his look or whatever. She immediately is like, what are we doing? What's happening here? And in case we miss it, there's all these little parenthetical things that John puts in of, yeah, this shouldn't have happened. Jews and Samaritans, they had no dealings. There's all this history there. There's this ethnic stuff going on. There's this cultural stuff. There's this religious stuff that we get a little bit of in what Jalen just read for us. There's a lot here between these two people. They are coming from two very vastly different places on all the things that at that time mattered most to people in terms of where you got your identity from, right? And fill in the blank if you want to modernize this, right? These are people from vastly different places, ethnically, racially, politically, whatever you want to sort of modernize that. This is an unlikely thing to be happening. Borderline inappropriate, honestly. Borderline inappropriate, why do I say that? Because by the time Jesus' disciples come back and he's still having this interaction, which means probably this isn't even the sum total of it. Probably this isn't a transcript of it so much as a summary of it. It might have been hours long that he's talking to this woman. By the time disciples come back, they're like, interesting. They noted that he was talking to a woman, but by then they have a sense of, yeah, he's playing by a different set of rules, so they don't say anything. But John feels the need to point out, yeah, we noticed. We thought it was interesting. But I distinctly remember we were like, you're going to say something? You're going to say something? I'm not saying anything. It's literally what it basically says. In the middle of it, so she points this out. They have this interesting interaction about water and living water, and she doesn't quite get that he's on a spiritual plane. She's about done with the conversation, which is the first verse, verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." She's like, "All right, I don't know what we're doing. If you're working at some other spiritual level or whatever, like, I just need my water." She says, "Let me know, email me when you figure out where this living water that you're talking about it is. I'd love to go there. I hate this well. It drives me nuts. Too far away. I have to come here at noon. It doesn't work for me. No one comes with me. If you find this living water, like, I would love the Poland Spring tank in my home." Right? Is basically what she's saying. I read a commentator this week who said, by the conventions of conversation at that time, this is almost certainly a conversation ender. She's done. She's walking away. I don't think frustratedly. I don't think offended or anything. She's just kind of like, okay, we did what we did. I don't know what you're doing. I have a feeling you're trying to like do some other thing. And she's like, I'm good. Like, if you're trying to go deeper here, I just need my water. Jesus said to her, verse 16, "Go call your husband and come here." It's such an interesting thing, right? First of all, if we don't have the rest of the conversation, this just comes off wild, right? Like, I'm sorry, what did you say, right? Go call my husband and come here. She's done. She's leaving. And Jesus says this very strange, mysterious. Just think of how interesting this is. She's done. She's leaving. And Jesus sort of calls out to her, "Hey, go call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, I almost picture her saying this over her shoulder. "I have no husband. Thank you very much." Jesus said to her, I know. You're right in saying I have no husband. If you've had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband, I know what you're saying is true. I know. That's what he's saying. Okay, what does it mean to have five husbands? Right, in our modern context, right, as much as there's still massive issues with women and how women are treated culturally, but in our time, women do have a lot more choice than they would have had 2,000 years ago. A lot more agency in things like marriage than they had back then. So you've got to put on a little bit of your cultural garb, right? To have five husbands probably doesn't mean that this woman is just living wild, going crazy, and jumping from man to man. Women don't tend to have that type of agency back then on their own, right? This is probably, instead, her being handed along by five husbands. That's what most commentators will tell you who understand the context, right? We jump right to sort of her own moral sort of shadiness. Whereas culturally, to have five husbands means that you have most likely been mistreated by five different men who didn't fulfill the obligations that they had, even some of the obligations that are in Scripture in terms of if your husband dies, you know, his brother has to marry, all of this stuff, that there is some handing along here. What I think is going on, where I have landed on this, where we have landed on this in many discussions of this text, is surely her story is some combination of her own sin and the sin of others. Right? Because that's all of our stories, right? And so, yeah, is there stuff going on? Does she have some agency at all in this? Maybe, we don't know. But certainly, this is at least her being sinned against, her suffering at the hands of just being tossed along. And now the man that she is living with won't even take her as his wife, most likely because of the story that goes before her. So there's all sorts of stuff going on. Do you see how saying, "Go call your husband and come here," after she says, "Hey, if you know how I can get living water, you let me know." Do you get why he says what he says? It is the perfect way. It is the perfect way of him gently touching the nerve that he knows will make her go, "There's something else going on here." He goes to the deepest place of her woundedness, the deepest place of her sin and shame. And he says, "You want what I have to offer? Before you leave, let me know who you're actually interacting with. Because I could give it to you in spite of even that." Right? Because most likely, if she has some sense of Jesus trying to go deeper here, she's like, "He don't know who he's talking to." I think that that's the primary thing that we get, the primary vibe we get from the early part of this interaction is she is going, this guy is talking to the wrong person. Whatever he's trying to do here, if he knew the one who was talking, he says to her, if you knew the one who was speaking to you, I would give you living water and you would never thirst again. And I think every single part of me thinks in her mind, she goes, and if you knew who you were talking to, you would know I was the last person in the world worthy of it. And then Jesus, in so many words, says, I know exactly who I'm talking to. I think in verse 19, I'm convinced the more that I interact with, I think she's still deflecting. The woman said to her, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. And now she gets all theological. Our fathers worship on this mountain. Do you agree with this side of things or that side of things, right? Some things never change, right? Like, hey, this news item that's hot right now, do you think this or do you think this, right? She's trying to place him. She's trying to say, okay, this is getting really personal. Let's go out there, right? Let's talk about that out there. Right? This is one way to keep God at bay. You always make God an issues thing. Well, where is God at on this issue? Where are Christians at on this issue? Where's your church at on this issue? And Jesus is going, could you remove your hand? I want to talk to you. I want to deal with your stuff. Okay? Not that that stuff isn't important, right? Jesus engages it here. He actually doesn't dismiss her. He doesn't say, deflecting, let's get back to the topic. He goes with her, but he weaves in all of his brilliance and wisdom, he weaves it back to say, when she says, so she gets through all of that, and she says, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Love that. What she's saying here is like, I think the only person who could untangle both out there, how complicated everything is, and untangle, like, you don't know who you're talking to, but maybe Messiah could. Maybe Messiah could, right? This is one of the shared hopes that the Samaritan people and the Jewish people both had. Jewish people had a sense of Messiah from the Old Testament. Samaritans actually had this Tahib, they called this figure who was to come, this one who would be a teacher and all that stuff. She actually uses Jewish. She uses the Jewish term here, which is kind of interesting because she knows who she's talking to. And she's like, when your Messiah comes, maybe he'll work all this out. And then one of the dopest things ever, verse 26, Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Or literally in the original language, he says, I am. That's literally what he says. He says to her what God said to Moses in the wilderness, in the burning bush. Maybe if you're not even familiar with Scripture, I'm just trusting you, you maybe have some sense of this. You remember what Moses says? Moses says, tell me your name. You know what God says? I am. Exact words that Jesus says here. She says, when Messiah comes, he'll tell us everything. And he goes, I wonder, right? I wonder if by now, right, Jesus is clearly seeing in and through this woman. He sees it all. I wonder if he knows she's sending out a little bit of bait. Like, when Messiah comes, because here's what's really cool about this. She then, after this interaction, she leaves enthusiastically. It says, literally, do we have this on the next slide? Or is it the last slide?
No, it's the last.
Okay, here's how it goes from here. Just then his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with a woman, in case you didn't believe that. They have an interaction with Jesus. And then it says this. Just then disciples came, blah, blah, blah. Okay, here it is. Verse 28, so the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, oh, it is up there. So the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? Can this be the Messiah? I wonder if Jesus knows she's sending him this little bit of bait because he sees into her heart and knows her heart is beginning to burn. And it's almost like Moses before the burning bush, and she is burning to know, tell me who you are. And so Jesus finally says, yeah, I am. The God of the universe has been sent to this dusty place, to this profoundly imperfect woman. Like, right, like think of Jesus, right? He's here for, as best as we can tell, 30-something years. He's public with what he's doing for maybe 3 years. And yet he chooses an entire afternoon for this one individual. And you almost get the sense that she is aware of that. Like, if I am standing in front of I Am, if I am standing in front of Tahib, If I'm standing in front of the Messiah, that's too good to be true because I know me, right? That's her, that's what's getting, that's the barrier. She's the barrier. Her own sense of her own worthiness, her own story, that's the barrier. And she's going, it can't be, it can't be, it can't be, it can't be. And then by the time he says, I am, and they have whatever else little wrap up of the conversation, she goes into the town, a town where as best we could tell, she's an outcast because she's there alone. You don't go to the well alone in the middle of the day when the water's already warmed up. You go in the morning when it's cool with the rest of the women in the town. She goes back to this place where apparently she's an outcast, and she's got one question on her mind. Can it be that God has reached down into my story and found me? As one commentator says, this woman's conversion is not so much based on her understanding of Jesus as much as the uniqueness of her experience of being understood by him. She says, no. And look what she says. Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Right? Hyperbole, granted. They didn't start on day one. He's like, remember that time in second grade, right? What is she saying? What she's saying is, he knows the stuff I don't want anyone to know. And if he knows that stuff and still has found me worthy to have this interaction, to offer me living water, to offer me himself, to offer me a captive audience, an audience of one with me. What? And he knows the whole thing. They're like, yeah, this woman, he doesn't know about your five husbands. And she's like, he brought it up. Yeah. He's the one who brought it up. Yeah. And they're like, what do you mean? She's like, I was leaving. I was out. I was a little weirded out by the whole thing. And like, what are we doing here? This dude says, call your husband. I said, I don't have a husband. I sassed him up like I normally do. And then he was like, I know you don't because you've had five husbands. They're like, wait, he knew? How did he know? He's from this area? No, he's a Jewish guy. He came from Jerusalem. He was on his way through. You think this can be the Christ? It's worth finding out. Yeah. And it says they go out to him. The whole city now has interaction. I would love to know what those 2 days consisted of. And they're like, stay with us, stay with us. And it says the whole city basically is converted. Again, probably a little bit of hyperbole, but whoever was under the sound of her screaming voice and whoever came back on day one and said, you've got to come back for day two, an entire city is utterly transformed. I always think of one of my favorite things, of the many things that Tim Keller said, pastor in New York City, that have deeply shaped me. One of the most profound things that he ever said that I was reminded of this week is actually something that Rach and I were talking about this week, was Keller says, to be fully loved but unknown is a superficial kind of love that we New Jersey people especially don't like. Oh, you're just the best. You're the greatest. You know what? You're wonderful, right? We get weirded out by that because you're like, you don't know me, right? It's superficial and a little bit strange. To be fully known and unloved is our worst fear. For some, to be, right? This is why breakups are so difficult. This is why certain things just mark us, certain kinds of betrayal mark us, because to be fully known, to give yourself fully to someone and then to be rejected by them, that's our greatest fear, which is why, by the way, we hold back these parts of our story. To be fully known and fully loved, that actually ends up being our greatest need. That's what our souls long most for, and might be the best definition of what I think Jesus is calling living water here that I've ever come across. Jesus is saying, you can be fully known and fully loved in me. That's what's available, right? And you can hear what part of that is kind of on us and what part of that is on him. He says, you bring me the part of your story that when someone touches it, it's like a nerve ending that sends your whole body into shock. You let me go there and you let me receive you and embrace you and call you forward and stick with you in that part of your story and experience being fully loved and fully known in that, and then be called into a community where, yes, sometimes imperfectly, right? The church sometimes hurts by asking people to be fully known and then not fully loving them. But man, what we're trying to do here, right? One of the ways that this guides us is what we're trying to do here is become a community where people can bring that part of their story and yet be fully loved. Because that's where lives change. That's where it gets, right? And Jesus doesn't just love us in some sentimental way, right? Like, Jesus goes to the cross and bears whatever created this part of this woman's story. He says, I will put my very body on the line. I will put my soul on the line to receive into myself the full weight of the woundedness, the full weight of sin, the full weight of your rebellion. And Jesus says, not only will I fully love you in terms of sticking with you and being present with you and comforting you and not ultimately either in the moment judging you or ultimately judging you, but like I will take the judgment on myself, right? Once and for all. That's what Jesus came to do. Which means, right, it is Vision Sunday, keep in mind. I would love to move to communion right now. But look, this is, we want this story to resonate with what we're doing. This story is the best argument I can think of for why we do this crazy thing called discipleship course, right? Where we ask you to invest time and energy and vulnerability into these Wednesday nights in order to bring your true self to bear so that we might be able to speak into that, so that God might be able to speak into that, such that you might encounter Jesus. Not in spite of that part of your story, but precisely there, right? And look, we do that steadily. We do that in a paced way that makes sense, right? We also want to provide the kind of content that is actually going to go to places where people's hurt and confusion actually are, right? This woman brings up immediately, okay, what's the temple? Where should we be? Where all of that stuff, right? Like the equivalent now is like, how do I navigate this crazy political thing, right? We just sat 45 people in a room every single Wednesday and talked about that, right? I don't know a lot of places. People think that that type of room is a hypothetical thing in our cultural moment, right? I know someone who's at a grad school near here who said, can you imagine a place where people on different sides of the political spectrum are actually friends and talking about these things? And this person sat in the class and was like, it's like in 3 hours, you can come to my church. Like, we're doing that, right? We did a thing about sexuality and gender this last semester, and like, that's really complicated in our cultural moment, and there's a lot to get, but like, let's engage it, right? Is Jesus not sufficient there? Can Jesus not speak in? Would Jesus back away and go, no, too much for me, right? And then these discipleship groups that we're doing this coming semester, where the first thing that we have you do is share your story. And again, we don't force you to go to the deepest, darkest place, but man, these contexts have a way, right? We're going to put you with people you know. One of the coolest things that I heard throughout last semester when we did these discipleship groups are friends, people who know each other deeply, who are like, I didn't know that part of my friend's story. Not that it was necessarily withheld intentionally, but just like there's a way when you get in a room and you're asked, yeah, go ahead, share your nine boxes, as we call it, right? Like there are these powerful things that happen and people just saying, yeah, I finally got to lay out that part of who I am, and then to receive in a room a sense of welcome, a sense of embrace, a sense of, wow, I didn't know that, a sense of, I see God in that. This is the stuff that fires us up, right? Our vision, you can put this up, Andy, our vision is breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together. That's what we see in the story, and that's the question that we're always asking. What are the barriers that are here to Jesus being encountered in life-changing ways? Right? This is why we do care group. We want your story to be open and available to each other. Again, not necessarily the dark recess, especially in care group, but like, what's going on with you, and where could you use a little bit of help? Where are you feeling thirsty? Where are you feeling worn out? Where are you feeling exhausted? Where do you need someone to come give you a little bit of help? A little bit of living water, right? This is why we get fired up when we hear about well teens and mentors connecting with our young people increasingly opening up to them. And even call, I've heard stories even this week of young people that you just wouldn't expect are now calling each other up into greater maturity and asking each other, like, hey, let's take this more seriously, right? As that vulnerability increases, right? Like, that's what you want to hear teens say. Let's take this more seriously, right? Like, those are wins. That's an exciting, wonderful thing. I think of our retreats, our men's and women's retreat, where it's almost cliche, but God is just super faithful. I think of a room full of men just a couple months ago who are moving about this room at this crazy place where we do men's retreat. And guys just encouraging each other and leaning into each other, right? Encountering Jesus together. Across barriers where, whether it's because interpersonally they shouldn't interact or just men don't do this, right? Like, we want to be a place where people go, well, how does that happen, right? And it's not how wonderful we are, right? It's the same person who made it possible here. We want the answer to the question to always be Jesus. He is the one who is being encountered in life-changing ways here. You'll hear a lot about discipleship course. That's kind of the big thing that we would love for you to jump into, right? Can you show that slide, Andy? You'll see this slide a bunch over the next few weeks. I'll just go over it real quickly. Kind of the idea is that there's a core curriculum that we want you to do. Don't get caught up in the academic language. We just feel like that there's a shared language around what we mean by discipleship, kind of a shared culture we're trying to create of discipleship that it's really important for you to understand before you jump into these smaller contexts. So we want you to do that. If you haven't been involved with discipleship, jump into the core curriculum this semester. There's a Sunday morning option. There's a Wednesday night option. We'd love for you to do that. For those of you who are through the core curriculum, how many of you were involved in discipleship groups in the spring? Yeah, a good number of you. So we're going to do that again in the fall. You know, you do your discipleship course, sort of 200 level as we call it, but in the spring we'll do these discipleship groups. Right, the whole point of discipleship groups, we have it under there. This is language that we would love to kind of pervade our community as we move forward, is that discipleship groups are relationally focused and practice-based. We want these to be places where there is deep relational connectedness, and then we want to live this stuff out together. That's why discipleship groups exist. We know that course is a little bit more content-driven. We want groups to be the place where the stuff that we're talking about begins to happen in sort of greater depth. Here's what that'll look like this semester. The core curriculum is emotional discipleship and relational discipleship. I know a few of you, those are like your last two that you need, and then you'll join us in discipleship groups next year. Again, a Wednesday night option at 7, Sunday at 11. For those of you who are in discipleship groups, we'll do the same thing where we're all going to come here for the first Wednesday on February 4th. So that's a date to put in your calendars. It's on your sheet here. But that's a really important date for us. And then those go every other week through the spring. If that's the way your group does it, you'll end in about mid-May. Here are our strategic priorities for the year. We are trying to create more opportunities for people to just be together, right? We do live in New Jersey. We know that people aren't ready to just jump in immediately, right? We know that you would tend to turn your back and leave the conversation and be like, cool, call me when you get it together, right? Like this is getting a little too personal. So we want to pace that out. We want to provide opportunities. We want to provide contexts where friendship can happen, where you can begin to connect to people. That's why we're doing a bunch of stuff at the Green Turtle. That's where we're doing bingo night and game night and all that stuff, right? Like, we haven't done that stuff in the past, but we realize as we grow, right, there are some people, if you're a 9 a.m.er, there are some people you're just not going to see who come to 11 a.m. gatherings that we want you to be able to have the opportunity to interact. We also, you know, want you guys to interact with each other. And so that's why we're doing all the stuff we're doing. That's why we're loaded up with more of those kinds of opportunities than we've done before. And then also, you'll hear way more about this in coming weeks. We are really trying to crack the nut of, man, what does it look like for evangelism to no longer be this buzzy word, but to normalize that a little bit and just make it normal that we would share, like we see modeled here by Jesus, that we would just share the good news of what Jesus has done in ways that actually make sense within our context. And so, again, you'll hear more about that over the next couple weeks. You were handed this when you came in. This is where we are practically headed. These are your big dates for the semester. Game night coming out, men's hangout. The discipleship group, I would probably highlight that when those begin. And then the one under it, D-Course sessions, when those begin. Those are dates that we're often asked for. You see the women's retreat down a little bit lower. We'll do the Patriots game again if you've ever been to that. That's a blast. Baptism Bash is on there as well. And you even have your dates for Well Kids Camp. That's where we're headed. This is a moment where we as leadership pause and say, how are we doing? Are we headed towards that? I can tell you that there's a strong confidence. Yes, like, let's keep moving in the direction that we're moving. Our greatest need as a church, as individuals, is to be fully known and fully loved, and this table is the perfect representation and the physical manifestation of that, right? Because we come to the table as people who want to be known by God, right? We come to the table in a place, the scriptures are very clear that the posture with which you come to the table is one of remembering what Christ has done and bringing honestly what we have done, right? And so it's a posture of repentance. It's a posture of bringing honestly, Lord, this is where I'm at right now. And so we come to the table in order to be fully known by God, and then this table is a representation, a tangible reminder, a weekly reminder that we have been fully loved in him. So if you're a follower of Jesus, this table is open to you. How we do it is we come down these two aisles. There's a gluten-free option in the middle, bread on the outsides, wine and juice. You can go ahead and take the bread and dip it in and then go out the sides. If you're not a follower of Jesus yet, man, bow the knee and jump in with what God is doing in the world, right? Believe today, right? Like maybe your heart was on fire as we were reading this and you know that you are in a season where God's got your attention, right? And maybe you are the barrier. Maybe you just believe, yeah, but if God knew me, right? Believe, like this woman believed, that it's possible that there is a God who loves you so fully that not in spite of your story, but in the midst of your story, he comes and makes himself available. If you make that decision, come to this table maybe as a first act of faith in him. But the scriptures are clear. If you're not there yet, you honor Christ most by just kind of considering what you've heard. The band will come forward and play for us, and then you can come to the table when you're ready. Let me pray. Father God, thank you, Lord, for this truth. Thank you for this beautiful story, Lord, of Jacob's well. Thank you for the example of this woman. And I love the honesty of this woman, the sort of authenticity of her reaction, Lord. It speaks so deeply to my own heart and to our context, Lord. There is suspicion here. There is doubt. There is shame. There are so many of the things that just war against our own souls. And God, you got through it. You're so personal in the way that you do that in our stories. And so thank you for that reminder. And Lord, I do pray for our church. I pray, Lord, as we stop and consider where we are and where we're headed, Lord, that we would increasingly, day by day, month by month, year by year, even decade by decade, if I could be so bold, Lord, be a church that is known as a place where this kind of thing happens, where barriers are broken, and Jesus is encountered, and people are changed, and cities, and New Jersey is changed, Lord. Lord, that's way too big for us, but it's not too big for you. Lord, give us our little part in that. And Lord, as we come to this table, may we bring our honest selves, our true selves, knowing, Lord, that you love when we are truly known, because then your love can go even deeper into our lives and into our stories. So make us open as we come to this table this morning. Praise in Jesus' name.